For the week of June 19th, 2016, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 325, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
How is it down south, Michael? You made it to Alabama. It's hot. It's really hot here in Los Angeles. It's going to be close to 110 degrees where I am today, if not surpass that. And in downtown Los Angeles, which is usually cooler, it's going to be 105 degrees.
And you just got back from Orlando. Sad week for Orlando, obviously, with the child being dragged into the lake by an alligator, God help us all, and of course the horrible shooting. I don't think we can add anything to those two stories usefully, but you did go to try and be a little happier. You did go to Orlando Universal, right?
Yes, Universal Studios Orlando. And what I would say is the only thing we could add to those two stories is that the alligator incident happened at Disneyland or Disney World, the Magic Kingdom.
Disney World, yes.
The same week that Disney Shanghai opened.
Well, I was going to use that for the same week that Finding Dory opened is more significant.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah. All right. But yes, I was at Universal Studios Hollywood, which is so trying to be like Disney that they actually...
Really? It falls that short?
Well, you can just tell they have two parks instead of just one. They should have just made it one big park, but instead they've kind of cut it into two parks. And then they have a train that goes back and forth between the Harry Potter lands, which are the Wizarding World of Harry Potter. There's two sections, one in one park and one in the Universal Studios.
Is it not one big price? You got to pay to access both.
You have to pay to access both separately, and of course, there's one big price if you want to, you know, kind of.
So it feels more like two lands rather than two separate parks.
Exactly. It feels more like, hey, you should have just combined these two things.
But how was it overall? Was it fun?
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm not an amusement park or a theme park kind of guy, but I found
it
fascinating.
Kids like it?
They loved it. They were amazed, fascinated. For them, who they've all read the Harry Potter books. They're really into Harry Potter right now at this age. They're 9 and 11, and they loved everything Harry Potter.
Cool.
And you know, what's really interesting is that a lot of these rides these days, it's all projection. It's all pseudo virtual reality or 4D where you're in a kind of a car or a chassis and they're projecting stuff at you while you wear 3D glasses or while you're just watching something.
It's all VR, you feel like?
Well, it's kind of like simulators.
Yeah. Oh, well, it's not like that at Disney World.
No, not yet. we'll see what
happens.
So
those are the best? They trump the actual physical rides in your estimation?
I don't like the physical rides. So, you know, certainly Transformers, the Transformers ride both in Orlando and here in Hollywood is very, very good, although can be quite queasy. And what's interesting about the big Harry Potter ride in...
Where you go into Gringotts.
Well, Gringotts, yes. Okay, Gringotts, that is in the new Harry Potter land in Diagon Alley, which is... That one is quite good and quite new. This is the one where you take a ride through Hogwarts with Harry Potter and Ron and Hermione and everything. The projection isn't nearly as good as it is in the newer version here in Hollywood, which just opened earlier this year.
Ah, well, there you go. So your kids are big fans of Harry Potter, and I'm sure they're big fans of the show. What will they hear about this week?
Well, on this week's show, after we talked about, you know, all the executive changes at Columbia Pictures last week, the executive shuffles at Fox and the turmoil at Viacom have our heads spinning. We'll be joined by Ann Thompson of IndieWire so she can explain it to us. And, you know, she's going to hopefully tell us why Hollywood is in turnaround. We're going to break down the worldwide box office as well, where a little fish swam a long way this weekend. Yes, audiences found the forgetful character from Finding Nemo, voiced by Ellen DeGeneres, super adorable, turning the Pixar movie Finding Dory into a box office smash. In music, we'll tell you if Amazon's plan to expand its streaming music service will be worth listening to. Also, CBS won a potentially significant lawsuit when it argued successfully that a remastered album can in fact be considered a brand new work in terms of copyright. This is very important. Music labels and artists and pretty much everyone is opening fire on YouTube, and we'll explain why. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. and we pull and look at the charts from ComScore, formerly known as RentTrack, and we supplement that with Box Office Profits and Mojo, Variety, The Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, you name it. The number one movie around the world is, of course, Finding Dory, the Disney Pixar blockbuster, $186 million worldwide, a record weekend for an animated film in North America. Normally, I don't like to make such qualified comments, but it seems viable in this case. Animation is pretty specifically different from every other genre, and it did set a big, big record.
My lead for writing about this for Celluloid Junkie was about the qualifiers.
Yes, yeah. Well, you know, I'm sick of, I like Box Office Profits. I even sent them an email saying, hey, come on, just compare three-day weekends to three-day weekends and four-day weekends. You know, if you're talking about an opening, the biggest number of all time for a Friday, you wouldn't throw in Saturday's numbers and say the biggest Friday ever was $400 million, which includes $200 million grossed on Saturday. You would say the biggest Friday is Friday. You know, why do you toss in the Thursday numbers? So now they say things like the opening weekend plus preview or opening weekend plus Thursday numbers. You know, they put it in parens and they take it out and they discuss the actual 3-day week.
Well, yeah, because it was the biggest single day opening of an animated film at $55 million. However, if you count the $7 million or the $9 million from the Thursday screenings, also, by the way, a record, then if you discount the $9 million, then Shrek the Third still has the single day highest earning for an animated
film. Are you sure that doesn't include Thursday previews?
It does not include Thursday previews.
Okay, good, because this is what we have to clarify every time now. And it's, hey, they have the highest grossing, Thursday opening, right?
Yes.
$9 million. They've got the highest four-day opening weekend. They have the highest three-day. Do they have the highest three-day weekend, even if you take out the $9 million?
Yes.
I believe they do, right. So, you know, five-day opening weekend gross from Wednesday to Sunday, four-day Thursday to Sunday, three-day Friday to Sunday, single days for each day of the week, fine. But don't toss in Thursday and Wednesday into Friday totals and say it's the opening weekend.
Hopefully we haven't confused our audience just by stating the days of
confused. They should be confused by all the numbers that other people use. We're saying, hey, give us the numbers for the actual days that you're talking about. Don't, if it's a four-day weekend, great. Tell us the four-day total. It's 3 days. Don't include the fourth day. That's not so hard to do. So, but since Finding Dory opened on Thursday, it has grossed $186 million worldwide. And it opened, of course, the same week as Shanghai Disney. The tragedy in Orlando about the poor child, what a dreadful thing. But that is a not a significant story in long term as far as theme parks are concerned. It's just a terrible, dreadful incident, but it's not significant, unlike Finding Dory, another film that will gross $1 billion, and the opening of Shanghai Disney, which has been a many years effort and will continue down the road. I don't mean to compare opening a park to the death of a child. I'm just saying that that story will not have long-term impact on the fortunes of Disney. So there's no reason to link it to the opening of Shanghai Disney. But another film that's grossing $1 billion worldwide this year, which is what Finding Dory will almost certainly do, combined with them opening up a $5 billion theme park in Shanghai, that's a big, big week for Disney.
Yeah, did you read the article in the New York Times written by, in part, by Brooks Barnes? About,
I did.
Yeah, that is a really good article because it goes into detail about just how much Disney had to concede to China and how China really owns most of this park.
Not really. They own more than 50% of the park.
Yeah, 58%.
And it's not China. It's the Communist Party.
That's correct.
Just to be clarifying, it's not even like, you know, Chinese citizens and billionaires. No, it's the Chinese Communist Party.
Yes.
That's who they're in bed with. Hello, Chairman Mao.
Yeah, which in a way, it's, you know, well, I don't want to get into the politics of it all, but I kind of...
Well, it's not a good idea.
Yeah.
They gave away too much.
I would agree.
You gave away majority control of the park, majority of the profits, and you're in bed with a one-party system that crushes human rights throughout the Chinese country. You know, that's something you may regret long term. Maybe they should have waited another 5-10 years. Eventually, China would say, we need you more than you need us.
Well, you know, what's interesting is they pointed out that 300 million people live within 3 hours of Disney Shanghai. I would say, and by the way, you look at the U.S. and you say, okay, there are two parks there and there's 350 million people.
Not 3 hours away.
But they're not 3 hours away. So you think, wow, of course they want it to open in China. Make perfect sense. But then what I would say is, you know, actually, of those 300 million people, how many can afford a ticket to Disney Shanghai?
Well, they have a 400, I think it's a 400 million person strong middle class, people making a, what they define as middle class and upper class. So they have a big, strong country of people who do have a good, solid living and can afford these expensive tickets.
No, I understand that, but the way it seemed
not
like,
within the 3 hours.
Right, exactly. That was my point.
But most of them, a lot of them, certainly within 5 or 10, because they're all concentrated along that corridor. They're not way into the hinterlands, you know. You're not going to find them in the plains of the Mongol, you know. They're there in Shanghai and Beijing and those major cities. So Paul Derek Garabedian of ComScore, you know, he sounds like Joel Siegel of Good Morning America. Not since Joel Siegel have we heard a quote like this. He said, Hollywood has been fishing for a box office hit.
And it's about Finding Dory. But you know what? Yeah. In his defense, it's really hard to come up with something interesting to say each week about the box office.
So, you know, Joel Siegel has somebody who has now officially replaced him. And to Paul Derek Garabedian's credit, he's not a critic.
So, that's true.
Whereas yeah. Joel Siegel was shameless, Derek Garabedian is just saying something catchy. They did mention that Finding Dory opened up on some extra IMAX screens sort of hurriedly. They said, oh, there's such big demand, we better put it on more IMAX screens. I don't know why it wasn't on a lot of them in the first place, though I assume it's because there's not a lot of demand since little kids don't like the IMAX cameras and they don't like 3D. What I did not hear a word about was the 3D breakdown.
You mean the IMAX screens?
Right. They're not a big fan of the IMAX screens. They don't like 3D. And so while I did hear that they bumped up the IMAX screens as opening day approached, I didn't see a word in Variety, Hollywood Reporter, or the LA Times about the 3D grosses for Finding Dory.
And that's a studio decision, but yes. And I'm not saying it's a right studio decision. I'm saying that it's,
we know it didn't do that. It's not important. If they had something to boast about, we would hear about it. It's yet another sign of how unimportant 3D has become. Well, even a big blockbuster film where 3D can work great, which is what computer animation 3D is, that's the ideal format for showing a movie in 3D, frankly. It's as easy to do there as anywhere else. It can really look impressive. People didn't care. And
well,
the studio
but when you think that like over 68% or 65%, I think it was, of the people seeing this movie were families, you're looking at, you know, some significant upcharge for 4 or 5 tickets to a movie rather than seeing the 2D version where you might be paying $20, $30 less in ticket price.
I did not see a breakdown saying 70% of the people attending were part of a family.
It was in Variety.
That seems high. Because the stories I saw were talking about, hey, you know what? There were a lot of strong nighttime screenings and people were going without kids.
Well, it says right here.
I believe you. I'm just saying, wow, that strikes me as interesting because I would not have thought it would be quite that high. And it makes the grosses all the more impressive because you're talking about a lot of children-sized tickets.
Yeah, actually, it was 65% of ticket buyers are families and older audiences with adults comprising 26% of the crowds. So that kind of tells you right there that 74% were children, and you're not going to be...
What?
Yeah. That's from Disney.
No, I'm saying 70... I don't know how they know that. How do they possibly know
that? They actually have checkers and spotters.
And they're extrapolating and guessing and doing estimates based on the cities that they're in, because obviously they can't know who's attending the movie all around the country with whom.
Oh, you'd be shocked. They have close to 2,000 checkers going out.
But I can see them checking grosses and ticket sales and all that, but I wouldn't see them taking pictures and going, okay, that's a family and that's not a family. And people go in, the kids and mother go first and the dad joins in later. Then he would look like a single guy. I mean, how would you know?
You know what?
People go to the bathroom. Some people go to
the bathroom. That's a show unto itself. So
You go. Well, that's interesting, though. Maybe we should have some people talking about these checkers all over the country, watching people as they go to the movies. What are they looking for? How do they do it? How does it work? I've never really heard about that. I have heard about Rotten Tomatoes, and I'm sick of people quoting the Rotten Tomatoes score.
Ugh, yeah, I know. Because it really, when it comes to Finding Dory, a lot of the critics said, look, it's an enjoyable movie.
It's fine.
Is it as good as the first? No. Is it a little hackneyed? Yes. But you know what? It's better than most of the Toy Story franchise. You know, non-Toy Story sequels.
Don't worry about it. It's okay. They said it's fine. It's okay. And that was the review. And if you give it a thumbs up, meaning it's okay, or all the way up to a brilliant classic that will last forever, that is a positive score on Rotten Tomatoes, and that helps it get towards 95%. If you say it's not okay, that's thumbs down, and they say it's got a negative score. So if everybody says, it's all right, it gets 100%.
That's correct.
If,
yeah.
If 70% of them say it's a masterpiece, I've never seen a better film, and 30% say I didn't like it, it gets a thumbs down, and it's a bad score, and it's not a positive film. So, you know, that's how the ratings work. I think they need to do a better job because so many people quote them. They really need to work on saying there's a distinction to be made between a 2-star okay, it's all right, and a 4-star masterpiece rave.
Well, yeah, but that's kind of where we are as a society these days. You're either good or you're bad. You're black or you're white. You're a Republican or you're a Democrat. You're a Tory.
I don't think so. I think we like information and we like it to be nuanced. Is it hot, meaning it's 72, or is it hot, meaning 104? I'd rather know it's 104.
Well, it's 104.
Yeah. So that's a lot to talk about Finding Dory. Let's get on to the other movies. At number two around the world is The Conjuring 2, another $60 million over the weekend, $190 million worldwide. Combined Finding Dory and The Conjuring 2, and you've ended the stupid two-week discussion of how nobody wants to see sequels.
Well, and look at The Conjuring 2. I mean, it's made, how much did you say?
$190 million worldwide on a $40 million budget.
Yeah, that's where I was headed with that. That's pretty good.
The first one was pretty well reviewed. The second one was pretty well reviewed. Finding Dory is pretty well reviewed. And more importantly, audiences are enjoying it. And so they're happy to see it. And studios are scratching their head going, why don't people want to see pieces of junk like Alice in Wonderland, Through the Looking Glass? Why don't they want to see Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles? I know it's terrible, but I can't understand why they're not showing up. Well, make a movie audiences enjoy, and they will arrive.
Well, they wanted to see, I don't know if they wanted to see Central Intelligence.
It did all right. It's Dwayne Johnson. It's Kevin Hart. It grossed $41 million over the weekend. A nice, solid opening for a nice, solid little buddy comedy. At number four around the world is Now You See Me 2. $25 million over the weekend, $91 million worldwide. I can see why they would think Now You See Me should have been a franchise, though everybody I saw who saw it was like, oh, it's pretty good. Nobody said it was great. Can't wait to see the next one. And box office profits, got to give another hat tip. They had a very funny line. They say the sequel's not doing as well because they avoided the obvious title. If the first one's called Now You See Me, the second one should have been called Now You Don't.
Oh, yes.
Yes,
that
exactly.
Is
so that lack of creativity, they had a potential franchise and they did not capitalize on it smartly. At number five around the world is Warcraft, $25 million over the weekend, falling like a stone in North America. Yes, we hate it, but it's at $370 million worldwide. Thank you, thank you, thank you, China.
Yes, because that's really where it made a lot of its money.
Yeah, so far that's the lion's share. At number six around the world is X-Men Apocalypse. $18 million over the weekend, $510 million worldwide. It is the second highest grossing X-Men movie of all time. At number seven is Me Before You, Teenagers Who Are Dying. We love them. $17 million over the weekend, $82 million worldwide. And number eight, that Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles sequel, $150 million worldwide, but it cost $135 million to make. That looks a little troublesome. And number nine is Alice Through the Looking Glass. Another $11 million over the weekend. It will hit $250 million next week. But again, a very pricey movie. And that looks like, it may have a long ways to go overseas. I'm not sure what territories are left. That's always a difficult thing to track. But that does not look good. And number 10, the Angry Birds movie. $330 million worldwide. And at number 11, another Disney film, it's The Jungle Book. It's made $7 million over the weekend. It's slowing down. It's at $922 million worldwide. It could be the fourth, fifth film from Disney to hit $1 billion this year.
Actually, it would be the third film this year to hit $1 billion, and Finding Dory could be the fourth.
I beg your pardon. So we have Captain America.
Yes.
And what's the other one? Zootopia.
Yes.
Both of those are from Disney. Jungle Book would be third, and Finding Dory could be fourth.
Correct.
So they've got $4 billion movies, $4 billion, and they haven't even gotten to Star Wars yet. But The Jungle Book is $75 million away, but it opens in Japan in August. That is the last major territory, so it has to do gangbusters in Japan, but maybe it could get there. We'll have to see. And one movie that opened up that we haven't discussed yet, Proof of Innocence. That's a South Korean drama. It seems to be about like a guy working in a law firm or an office. Somehow he's a manager and he gets caught up in a murder case because a prisoner sends him a letter saying, I'm innocent. And this guy starts to look into it, finds out there is some truth to it, and he gets caught up in this difficult, dangerous escapade trying to prove this guy's innocence. It's more of a thriller than a courtroom drama. But it opened a $3.5 million in South Korea.
What are you, like, throwing pots and pans around over there?
I'm knocking over crystal. I'm standing up near a, what would you call it, a cabinet. And there's a display of crystal, and I was waving my arms in excitement.
Okay. All right. Well, you know, I have to say, I haven't seen many of the Hollywood movies over the past 2 weeks. Not only because I was traveling, but I did see a movie, and I believe it's out now in theaters in the U.S. It's from Israel, called Princess. Have you seen this movie?
No.
It's from a couple years ago. So I guess it finally made it to the U.S., and it's on VOD, I'm sure, about a 12-year-old girl and how she kind of pushes these role-playing games with her stepfather into... It's worth checking out. It's a first feature, very interesting first feature, by Tali Shalom Ezer.
Well, I was struck by the two movies I mentioned 2 weeks ago, I think, Love and Friendship and The Lobster.
Ah, and yes.
Love and Friendship has passed $10 million, a great success story for Whit Stillman. And The Lobster's at $7 million and still chugging along. But what really struck me was the fact that when I looked at the charts, I saw that Love and Friendship is on 500 screens this week. 500 screens. And The Lobster is on, or was on, no, and Love and Friendship was on 800 screens last weekend. Now it's slowed down. It's on 500. The Lobster was on 500 screens. That's just mind-blowing to me. And I assume, I mean, those are small, quirky little independent films where once upon a time, you would have had actual prints, negatives, circling the country for a year, maybe 20 or 30 or 50 prints maybe. And that's how that would have been showcased around the country. And I assume, even though they're still paying a fee to get those prints, I assume it's just somehow a little cheaper and a little easier to spread them out because it's digital.
Well,
people can make that decision.
Logistically, it's easy.
Right.
So you can, you know, you don't have to, yeah, sure, you don't have to pay for prints. You do have to pay, in most cases, a virtual print fee.
Right.
Okay,
and
so,
is that lower now? A little bit? Has it been lowering, or will it lower? And
well,
is it going to disappear?
Well, it's going to disappear, A. And then I think
when?
The studios, within the next 5 years, definitely by 2019 in most of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly throughout, by 2022, I think... You know,
and is that being used to help theaters make the transition, or why is there a digital print fee? This means if a theater shows a movie, even if they just get a digital copy, they're paying as if they're getting a physical print shipped to them.
Correct. And the theater isn't paying, okay? It's the distributor that's paying this virtual print fee, because ordinarily they would have paid, you know, $1,500 to $1,000 per 35-millimeter print.
$1,500 to $1,000?
Yes.
You mean $1,000 to $1,500?
Correct, yeah. Somewhere
okay.
in there. Somewhere
so who would
in that
they pay
range.
That to?
They would pay that to the lab, right? And then they'd have to pay to ship it, and that costs money.
So who's
money.
Getting the money now?
Well, now it costs, you know, $200 tops to, you know, mm-hmm. duplicate a hard drive to send to a movie theater. Or
and
to
there
get
are no
it.
Labs left.
And there are no labs left. So, but to do that, the movie theater owners had to buy very expensive equipment.
And so it is going to the theaters to help them with their transition?
It is going to the theaters and the theater owners and the financing entities, integrators, that put those movie projectors and those digital servers and projectors into movie theaters.
Well, great. And is that fee lowering? Is it downgrading? Is it getting smaller? Because I'm just still a little surprised that The Lobster and Love and Friendship are on hundreds of screens.
Well, they're not lowering because, you know, basically the term, the length of time that distributors have to pay for this
okay.
virtual print fee, which is, you know, $800 here in the U.S., give or take, $500.
$1,000 to $1,500.
That's 35-millimeter prints.
Well, so the virtual print fee is lower.
The virtual print fee is lower than a 35-millimeter print.
Ah, well, that was my question. The virtual print fee is lower than the traditional print fee. So they're already saving money, so it's an easier economic decision for a theater to say, I'll pay $800 for this movie rather than $1,500.
The theater doesn't pay. It's the...
Oh, the distributor.
Yes.
Thank you again. So it's an easier decision for the distributor to say, well, I can be twice as many screens for the same amount of money I paid a few years ago.
Correct.
There we go. Okay, well, that's one reason perhaps why these movies are on 500 screens at a time, or they don't have to wait. Maybe they would have been on 500 screens 30 years ago, but they just had to wait because there weren't that many prints available.
Correct.
Oh, interesting. We know that all these things matter. This is, you know, money is going back and forth. Warcraft, we mentioned, the pay-per-view rights sold for that movie, 18 million... Oh. We know money changes hands every step of the way. For example, Warcraft in China, the Chinese pay-per-view rights sold for $18 million. That's a record for an international film in the Chinese market.
But what I would ask is how much
gets that money.
Yeah, that's what I would ask is who gets that money and how do they get it out of the country? Because as you know, Michael. Only like 17 and 25% of the money made in China can actually exit the country or be given to the foreign distributor.
And we know California is happy because they were named the top market for film production, including television, I assume, in the entire world.
Okay, I did not know that.
Oh, well, we have a link in our show notes. You can check that out. And of course, that's, you know, as a constant discussion, where is production fleeing? Why don't people want to see bad movie sequels? We've answered that question this weekend. We also answered the silly discussion of, oh, it's a box office slump. The summer box office slump. This is a nightmare. The box office was down 22% like 2 weekends ago. Why? Because they were making bad movies. And you were comparing it to the biggest annual box office grossing year of all time. So,
well, and you were comparing it to...
If you step down from last year, that's okay. You don't have to set a record every year. That's not possible. So relax.
Well, and I think they were also comparing it to Jurassic World, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, that's the whole point. Yeah, week to week is stupid, you know, and year to year, put it in context. Last year was the highest grossing year of all time. You expect this year to be bigger, or and if it's not, you're going to say it's a disaster? That's stupid.
Well, you know how in later years of a television series, fewer and fewer people watch, unless apparently you're Grey's Anatomy, in which case more and more people watch.
Yeah, but, or Law and Order, yeah.
But that said, you know, I kind of look at the, you know, movie industry like that now. It's like, okay, yeah, we've been watching this series for a while now. In fact, you're on Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles 20 and Transformers 30. It's like, we get it, okay? We don't need to go see, you know, season 5 of this show anymore. Like, I don't watch Modern Family anymore, not because I don't necessarily want to. I just don't have the time and newer shows have come along that have interested me more.
Well, but... You can make long-running series of stuff if people enjoy it.
Correct.
You know, if they're good. It's just you can't make junk. People are not getting fooled by junk anymore. However, that's the movie industry. We've beaten it to death. What about the music industry? What's happening there?
It's already beaten to death.
Yes, absolutely. We've crushed it.
Well, okay. So look, if you don't want Amazon Prime, how about paying for Amazon Video and Amazon Music? What do you think, Michael? Now that Amazon is offering its video offerings as a standalone service, and I know we're talking about music, but they're preparing... to offer, you know, a standalone service for music streaming. Amazon says it will offer similar catalogs as Spotify and Apple, which could be a big step up from the relatively anemic offerings that they now have on Amazon Prime Music. There's no word if a more robust catalog will be offered in their Prime package, but the music service will be $10 a month. What do you think? Are you going to go for this, or are you already on Apple Music? Do you have Spotify?
I do not subscribe to Amazon Prime. I don't subscribe to Amazon Video, and I won't subscribe to Amazon Music, but I'm unique because I have tons of albums sent to me all the time. It makes sense, right? They've got the offering. They can make it available standalone. Why not? They can get an additional 10 people, assuming they don't spend a lot of money to launch it. They've made money, right? It's found money.
Right. I mean, right now what they're doing is they have deals with certain record companies, and it is anemic, the offering that they have on Amazon Prime Music. It's like, oh, okay, you don't have X, you don't have Y. Oh, geez, you don't have much. But when you buy an album from them, a CD... they have a deal where you can, you know, auto rip it where, you know, okay, here's the MP3s of the same thing. I like
that. Well,
that's
if you buy the CD, then you get the digital copy right away.
Yeah, I like that. You know, if I bought a book, I'd want the same thing, but they don't offer that because publishing companies don't want that. And frankly, I'd rather, you know, have the option of going paper or electronic. But again, publishing companies don't want that. Look, I'm already on Spotify, so... you know, all my playlists.
Are you an Amazon Prime member?
And I am an Amazon Prime member. So if it is a part of the Prime Music, sure, you'll
get it.
I'll get it. But at some point, they're going to have to start drawing the line as to what they include with Prime and what costs extra.
Why? If they're making money off $100 a year.
Well, yeah, but right now they're losing money on Prime and they're happy to do so because they make money on the margins of us buying, you know, their customers buying from Amazon rather than going to department stores, which is, I don't know if you've seen the returns from department stores lately, but they're all going out of business, partly, if not entirely, because of folks like Amazon. And instead of, you know, how many times have you said, Michael, oh, I can just get it on Amazon?
I understand. Amazon's a big competitor. Yes.
Yeah. And so at some point, it's going to be unprofitable or not very profitable for them to include video and music and all of this other stuff along with the delivery of goods.
But it's the Walmart approach. You crush everybody else. There's no local hardware store. There's no local grocery store. There's no local, you know, tile or carpet store. You have to go to Walmart, right? There's nobody else left in your town.
Home Depot.
No, I'm just saying, but that's the idea, right? You crush the local businesses. You're the only game in town, and then they keep shopping at you because you have lower prices at Walmart. People still go to Walmart.
Right.
Right? The Amazon's trying to do the same thing online.
Walmart did get in trouble for that with the drugstore.
Well, sure. Yeah. People hate them, but nonetheless.
No, they actually lost.
They made gazillions of dollars, and you know, the family's wealthier than God.
They lost a lawsuit, I believe, in Arkansas.
Okay.
Where they
so
were,
what? They're still a gazillion dollar company.
Yeah, it was like kind of one of those congratulations, you know, hometown pharmacies. You have won a lawsuit against Walmart. Yeah, you should still file for bankruptcy.
Right. Anyway, is this going to work? Is this going to help make more people join Amazon Prime?
I don't think necessarily it's going to make more people join Amazon Prime. It will be one of those things. Well, I'll get the music too. Sure. What it might do is affect how many people feel the need to subscribe to Spotify or Apple Music. If they can do it right, it could affect the other streaming services, they include it in Prime, because so many people are Prime subscribers.
Well, it is included in Prime, absolutely.
Well, and what I would say is Prime is not everywhere, okay? So if you live in Hawaii, for instance, you don't...
Well, the digital offerings are everywhere.
Correct. No? And again,
we're talking about a digital offering here.
Right. Prime isn't international. I don't know how many countries Prime is offered in. But I wonder how far Amazon will be able to go in territories such as Australia, Europe, Asia, South America, whether they'll be able to offer this as well, because that's what Spotify has done. That's what Netflix has done. And that's where they're making, that's where they're kind of beefing themselves up.
Well, I'm sure they'll want to do it in as many territories as they can if it's profitable.
That's true.
And the record labels will want to continue putting out remastered albums if they can extend the copyright from now until the end of time.
Well, that's true. And this case is sure to be appealed. But CBS, they still won a lawsuit over royalty rates with a legal argument that it's going to have massive, wide-ranging implications if it is upheld on appeal. And here's the story. Copyright law, and we're going to do this quickly, okay? Copyright law was set in a way in the United States that did not include music recorded before 1972. Specifically, this means that radio stations could play any music, like the entire output of the Beatles and Billie Holiday and so on. Anything before 1972 they could play without paying a penny to the rights holders of that music. It was in the public domain, at least for broadcast radio.
I'm not sure if that was intentional or not. That's what I have never quite understood. It sounds like they just put the law in place in 72 and didn't make it retroactive, but it didn't seem like there was a lot of thought behind it, but that's what happened.
Right. There wasn't. It's a complete mess.
Okay.
Now, no one cared because, you know, radio play was seen really as a promotional device to sell singles and albums. But of course, now that no one is actually buying singles or albums, people care again. Copyright holders and record companies have found success demanding payment from radio by citing state laws. So they said, okay, well, the federal copyright law doesn't allow this, but state laws do. It's a mess. It's a
giant
mess. Just
like California?
Yeah, or California, where they'll say, oh, well, in Maine, we can collect money.
Okay.
The folks holding the rights to certain Al Green music sued CBS Radio, and CBS Radio's lawyers came up with a really novel argument. They weren't playing music from before 1972, because the music was remastered. It was essentially, quote-unquote, new music and fell under newer copyright laws. In other words, when it suited their purposes, the radio stations played music from before 1972 and argued it was in the public domain, at least for broadcast. Then when it suited their purposes, the radio stations played music from before 1972, but focused on the fact that it had been remastered for CDs and digital output or whatever, so they could maintain the lowest royalty rate possible, because of course they really just pay the ASCAP fee, the ASCAP broadcasting fee, and then they can play whatever they want. They just don't want to have to pay it for these pre-1972 songs. Guess what? The judge agreed. If this decision stands, this will mean that music would essentially never enter the public domain, since labels or whoever could always remaster the music and extend their control over it. And, you know, that might also cover, say, movies and TV shows that are put onto Blu-ray, for example, because they're remastered. And maybe books that which are re-engineered for e-readers would also be considered, quote unquote, new. I should probably stop doing the quotes, but
a lot of quotes. Yeah. So this is a really interesting, bizarre put yourself on your head case, because, you know, they're using one argument to keep no rates. And then they're using another argument, usually designed to help protect artists. And they're embracing that argument so they can pay a lower royalty rate. So it's kind of crazy. The idea that an old album from the 30s and you remaster it and say, oh, well, it's new, we've substantially changed it, is kind of specious, but they bought it. So we'll have to see if it stands up on appeal. It doesn't make any sense if you just look at it on the face of it, does it?
No, not at all. I mean, I think it's another example of the legal system not understanding the technology.
I mean, you're bringing out stuff that maybe couldn't be heard until the new technology is available, but you're bringing out what was put onto tape 70, 80 years ago. You're not creating some new artistic work.
Correct.
That's what I would say. So it's a lot of fights over music, and there's a lot of fights over video too, right? YouTube. Everybody has suddenly got their sights pointed at YouTube. The record labels, the artists, you name it. Everybody is speaking out about YouTube. They're angry because YouTube is a big billion-dollar company, and they don't pay a lot in royalties as far as these people are concerned.
Right. Now, this copyright case that we just talked about, yes, that is U.S.-centric, and the copyright laws are U.S.-centric, although I will point out that many of the copyright laws kind of synchronize themselves throughout the international market.
Everybody sort of copies everybody else a certain degree.
It's just easier, frankly, to keep them all in sync. Not always. You know, there's differences.
Now, well, Europe's public domain is sooner. It's like 50 years, I think.
Right, exactly.
For music.
Now this,
so I can go to England and London and find albums that came out 50 years ago, and they're nice and expensive, well-done box sets. But in the U.S., they're still wildly expensive because they're still considered under copyright.
Well, now, with this YouTube stuff, we're also talking about the music industry, and we're talking about, really, you know, the industry is focused on, hey, YouTube, you're playing all our music. People are subscribing to, you know, artists on YouTube, and they're playing the videos. And
on demand. I want to hear this song. I want to hear it now. They go to YouTube, and they play it.
Right, because it's coming out of their computer speakers or even through their stereo, frankly. But how much money are you making? Because we want some of that.
So major labels are renegotiating or doing a new agreements with YouTube, aren't they?
Well, they're trying.
They're licensing agreements. They're up for renewal or extension.
Right.
And what are the licensing agreements?
Pay me.
That's just so YouTube has the right to play their music?
Right. Basically, and it's, you know,
it's different. Like radios or restaurants can just play one blanket ASCAP or BMI license.
Correct.
And be able to play stuff. If you're YouTube, they have to go to each individual label or major labels or groups representing them.
That's right.
And negotiate individual rules to say, okay, we can play the music from Sony.
That's right, because it's not over-the-air radio. It's on demand.
And while they're negotiating with them, there is the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, and there's a big push in Congress to reform or change the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. The music industry wants it to be easier to remove unauthorized content, and that's what they seem to be claiming is the problem. You've got the record labels, and you've got artists. In fact, this week, there's going to be an ad in Roll Call, which is a political newsletter that goes to members of Congress, signed by 180 artists like Paul McCartney and Taylor Swift and Carole King, all saying we've got to reform the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. It's too easy for people to post music illegally on YouTube that they don't have the rights to.
Well, it is. And the safe harbor law, meaning, hey,
it is. I mean, we put on trailers and we got pulled down.
Right.
I thought it was pretty easy to catch people nowadays.
It is, at least when it's video content, because they can kind of thumbprint the video. They can also thumbprint the audio. But what some labels have said is, okay, no, keep the music up. Okay, we know that that's our music. We want to take the advertising revenue. We'll split the advertising revenue from that particular song or from that particular post.
Well, is it hard for them to catch the people breaking the rules, or is it hard, or are they just saying we want to make more money off this illegal usage of our music?
I think it's the latter. I think they're saying, look, hey, use that, you know, use the music because it is making us money. We just want to make more money.
So but they're complaining. They're complaining that a lot of people are using their music illegally. And there is an automated system that YouTube uses called Content ID. And they say, right, hey, that works great.
And there are some independent artists who say, I can't afford Content ID. I don't have a Content ID account. So that makes it really hard. And frankly, all on our end, people who actually create videos and stuff for YouTube, we see an abuse of the DMCA. All we see is people, studios and record labels massively blanketing people with, you know, cease and desist orders when they have no right to be doing it.
Content ID is an algorithm that basically says this content is the same as that content and that content. So content A is the same as content B, and copy B is copywritten by, you know, person XYZ. So you have to take it down. Content A has to come down. Okay. Because it's effectively content B, which is owned by somebody else.
And what I've been hearing for years is that the studios abuse this.
Well, it's
system.
There's two things going on. There's two things going on. One, Content ID is just kind of, you know, it's a sledgehammer, and it just goes, okay. Oh, nope, that's a trailer. And even though we were talking over that trailer, okay, and commenting on, this was back in Cannes.
Right.
Okay, we were mentioning, hey, this film was, you know, premiered in Cannes, and let's talk about the film, and here's a clip from it as we talk over it. So that even the audio wasn't, you know, there. It still recognized the video, pulled it down, and said, oh, you have copyrighted material on your video. Now, when you get, you know, 2 days worth of video uploaded to your site every hour, you can't look at each individual clip. And so there's, you know, an automated way of doing that. The problem is that you're more often than not going to kind of spot a whole bunch of legally posted material and take it down. So what YouTube has done is allowed people like us to write to them and say, actually, no, this is, you know, this is legal. This is fair use. It's a news story, and they will put it back up. But it's a big pain in the neck for content makers like us.
Right.
Now, as far as the DMCA is concerned and whether the studios and record labels are abusing it, yes, they do, because they will send tons they have whole departments that just send takedown notices to folks like Google saying, hey, take X down, take Y down, take Z down. And of course, what winds up happening is Google or whoever, YouTube, takes down the link or takes down the content. The content creator that created that content then has to contact Google or YouTube or whoever it is and say, no, it's legitimate. And then, I mean, it's a back and forth. There's like a whole process, but the process is so onerous that really only people with a lot of resources can do it. This has really frustrated the Googles and Yahoos of the world because it's just so time consuming and so expensive for them to police. At the same time, it's saved their neck because they're basically saying, we are just a pipe. We are just the
which
place.
Is true.
Yes, which is true.
It's like holding YouTube responsible, you know, Ma Bell responsible for phone calls.
Correct. We're just the tool that is being used to transmit this content. That's it. So we're not posting this, you know, video or music illegally. Our users are. Go after them. It saved them, but at the same time, they have to spend an awful lot of time, energy, money, resources to actually police the DMCA.
And all of this is a lie. All of this is a distraction from what they really care about.
Money.
It's only about money. YouTube in 2015 paid out $385 million in the U.S. to record labels for videos and things created on their site.
That really seems like way too low, but that's...
In 2015, vinyl generated more money. $416 million off sales of 17 million LPs. $385 million in 1 year, which is probably more than they ever paid out before. And that's really damn low. Spotify, in comparison, paid out $1.8 billion in 2015. And we've seen record, you know, industry music profits plummet. People can get music for free. They don't pay for it. Spotify has 100 million active users. They're about to announce that in Cannes at a convention. That's grown from 89 million people. Hundreds of millions of people use YouTube, don't they?
Yes.
And they're just not paying enough money. And the record labels and the artists and everybody wants higher royalty rates. They want them to pay higher royalty rates. The fact is, YouTube says, we've paid out $3 billion worldwide in the last decade. $3 billion! To which you say, over the last decade, well, that's $300 million a year, which is a pittance compared to the $7 or $8 billion that the industry has collapsed over the last decade. They're just not paying a high enough royalty rate. And if they paid a higher royalty rate, everybody would relax about the cease and desist and take it down and put it up and all that sort of stuff. They would just embed ads and make sure they profited from everything.
Well, let me point out, you say that it collapsed $7 to $10 billion.
More than that, probably.
That's per year.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're basically what, 7 times 10 with $70 billion in the hole. And they're getting, and that is where you get this analog dollars, or sorry, digital dimes for analog dollars. And right. It is true. I mean, if you really look at what the YouTubes of the world are making in advertising revenue, it's true. It is less than radio, for instance. What you, they could get for radio if people were listening, but since so few people are listening, radio is earning less now.
And so here's an idea. Do not renew with them. Do you know what? Tell them they got to pay a higher royalty rate or you won't renew. Spotify, Pandora, YouTube, eventually their agreements come up and the labels and the artists have to stand firm and say, you're not paying nearly enough royalty rate. Either you pay us or you don't get the music.
Well, and what Spotify is saying is, here's the deal. We are giving you 75% of all of our revenue. Okay.
I don't care if your business model is too high. You know what I'm going to say. If your business model means you have to profit off, you know, devaluing our music, then you should go out of business.
Well, that right there is the issue is, wait a second. So you gave all the music to everybody for $10 a month. Maybe that's the problem.
Yep. And they're paying five times as much last year as YouTube.
Right. Well, right. But at
so
the
they're,
same-
they're forking out a lot more money than YouTube. You know, if Spotify paid $1.8 billion and YouTube paid $1.8 billion, guess what? That's another $1.5 billion in the kitty. That starts to add up.
That's yeah. I mean, that would be at least, you know, for now, a big deal.
Yeah, that's right. It's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Oh my God, I've been taken over by Sperling.
Well, thank you, Michael, for taking over my responsibilities there and explaining Big Deal or Big Whoop. Our first story, MoMA, the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, has fired an assistant film curator of more than 30 years standing over the controversy surrounding the removal of a film about North Korea from the museum's schedule. Sally Berger was fired for her role in the fracas about Under the Sun. The film had been accepted for viewing despite the government of North Korea objecting to the project. Berger, citing what happened to Sony after it went ahead with the comedy The Interview, you might recall that little moment in time, well, she expressed concern about showing the movie and then yanked it from their schedule, MoMA's schedule, apparently without consulting others. After discussion, Berger has been fired and the movie welcomed with open arms if the director is still interested. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal to Sally Berger, obviously. There must be more to this, or I don't understand it. I mean, it's a stupid mistake. I thought it when they announced that they were yanking the film. Why the heck, you know, made no sense. But you're firing somebody after 30 years over one decision? I assume she had other issues developing over the years, because if that's the reason and they just wanted to show they took some action, then that was a wrong choice to make.
That is usually the case. There is usually kind of something that builds up over time.
I guess.
In instances like this, although not always. So
sometimes they want a head to roll, and I hope that's not the case.
The upscale drama Nashville has found a good old country welcome at CMT. How did I do with my accent there? Since
pretty
you're...
damn good.
Okay. The cable channel gets first-run episodes of Nashville from now on, and the next day they'll air on Hulu, which maintains stacking rights, as they're known, to all new episodes from the new season. They're ordering an entire 22-episode season, so fans will get the answer to that fourth season cliffhanger, and Lionsgate will hit that once magical mark of 100 episodes, although it doesn't mean as much without syndication. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, right? I mean, more and more shows, you know, you're there for 3 or 4 years. If you want to continue and it makes sense, it can happen. It used to be just a pipe dream, you know, once in a blue moon, HBO or PBS or one other network, you know, NBC would pick up Taxi after ABC, you know, canceled it. That nowadays it seems to happen pretty often. It happens more for sitcoms, but really it seems like it's not so crazy anymore.
Didn't Different Strokes move from one network to another?
That does not ring a bell, but I won't say it's not true.
Having lost a massive court case to Hulk Hogan, something I never thought I'd say, Gawker and its owners are doing some financial and legal maneuvers intended to protect themselves and their company. They're declaring bankruptcy, as is Nick Denton, the head of Gawker, and turning around and suing Hogan, arguing that essentially handing him control of the company by awarding Hogan $140 million would be an onerous and unfair result. Meanwhile, the debate over a free press versus the right of billionaires to fund lawsuits targeting a media company they don't like continues to heat up. And we should probably explain that, but is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Yeah, this is a little complicated. I mean, you know, I understand it's just financial and legal maneuvering to protect themselves. I understand why they're doing this, suddenly suing the guy that they were found to have wronged in court. Okay, it's just maneuvering. But everybody seems to be making this like a First Amendment case, or how awful to have a billionaire, you know, target a company he doesn't like. You know, it's out of control, you know, oligarchs, one percenters. It doesn't seem to be what this case is about. I mean, if this guy, Peter Thiel, he was outed by Gawker, and he decided, I don't like them. And he started to look around.
Wait a second. He wasn't outed by Gawker. Peter Thiel is one of the founders of PayPal, and he gave an interview to the New York Times who said, and in the interview he said, I funded Hulk Hogan's lawsuit against Gawker.
No. He was outed by Gawker as a gay man and decided I don't like them.
Okay, sorry. I thought you meant like outed as like funding the lawsuit. Okay, sorry.
Anyway, so he was outed by Gawker and said, I don't like them, and I feel like they crossed a line, and that's not journalism. That's just sleaziness, and I think it's bad and dangerous. And he started looking around for cases that would be worthy of him funding, because he feels like a lot of people have a case against companies like this but can't afford to do it. And he found Hulk Hogan, and he backed his case financially. And I'm shocked at the idea that Hulk Hogan, a famous celebrity, couldn't afford to sue Gawker, or at least couldn't afford to find lawyers willing to take on the case for a cut of the profits. Yeah. But perhaps that's the case. And if he was funding frivolous lawsuits that had no merit, then I would say, okay, now you're making a case that this is a dangerous thing. You know, billionaires funding stupid litigious lawsuits just to try to drain money out of a company, that would concern me. But Hulk Hogan's case seemed to have validity. Certainly a judge or jury agreed. So I don't see that this is a First Amendment issue. I feel like this is a Gawker being sleazy and crossing a line issue.
Well, Gawker was sleazy. They did cross a line. I will say that when a jury hands an award over that is like three or four times the amount of money that the company earns in a year, I don't see how that is. That's not going to help anybody, because there's only one outcome to that. Nobody wins.
Well, if a company deserves to go out of business, it does.
Well, in this case, that's probably what will happen. We'll see what happens to Gawker. Certainly they say that, you know, it's basically going to thrive under new ownership. Speaking of thriving, now, we all expected this, Michael. The Tony Awards certainly enjoyed a Hamilton effect. The awards show hit a 15-year high by reaching some 9 million viewers in the overnights, and the show was marked by a notable number of thoughtful, funny speeches by the winners. Of course, the real winners will be the shows that can turn the spotlight of the Tonys into big box office. So the result of numbers performed by, say, The Color Purple and others will be shown in the months to come. The magic didn't work for Steve Martin's Bright Star. I guess he wrote that with Edie Brickell. It's already posted a closing notice, and based on their performance on the Tonys, I can understand why. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big whoop. It's a one-year blip, and they reached 9 million viewers, which shows that, you know, even at their best, the Tony Awards is a niche audience award thing. But hey, I thought...
But those are the overnights. Those are the overnights. We'll get to that in a moment.
That's right. That is an issue that we'll get to in a second. But yeah, you know, we finally got this week's box office. I don't see any big, big winners in upturn in box office, but I don't mean that they're losers either. You know, The Color Purple and other shows that had some good numbers as far as people... Color Purple dropped 100,000 last week. So... they'll have to hope for another week or two that the trickle-down effect of being on the show will come into effect and, you know, boost the box office. I felt like, again, there were a lot of great speeches, but people blew their chance. They're also determined to feature every person in a show in three or four numbers, that they create medleys that have no emotional impact. School of Rock did it great.
They did a great job. I totally agree with you.
Yeah, they had the opening number, a big opening number. It worked well. And yeah, it featured most of the cast. But the important thing is that it has a big number that worked really well and worked. Color Purple had a great number, but they did pieces of it and two others. Waitress had a great opening number in their show, but they chopped it up and did three different numbers. It's just, I feel like they really are blowing an opportunity. Hamilton, frankly, they didn't do a very good job. Well, they blew their wad on the Grammys.
Yeah, they did. And I think they knew that. And so they were like, well, we can't do the same song again, especially since they opened the Tonys with a kind of modified version of that song.
Yeah, a little satire, which was that I thought worked well.
Especially when the whole, you know, they went to reach for the Tonys and James Corden said, not yet.
No, I said, but that worked fine. But then when they did their number, I didn't think it was a good choice of a number. I didn't think it was staged well. It wasn't shot well. There was a lot of problems with the camera work again for live performance. They messed up via camera work Spring Awakening. They messed up the beginning of the Waitress medley because of the camera work. That's a big problem. So I thought in general, it was a fun show. I loved a lot of the speeches. Hamilton's cast album jumped back up to number 3 on the Billboard charts. It's the first cast album in the top 10 since the Book of Mormon and only the 3rd in 50 years. You have Hair, Book of Mormon, and Hamilton. That's how rare it is to have a cast album in the top 10.
Well, and of course, right after the Tonys, everybody left. Literally, the entire cast is now gone.
Yeah.
Or no, will be on July 9th.
A few people have left. Philippa Sue, she'll be joining Amelie, a musical that she apparently worked in the original reading on, and that's going to come to Broadway. Lin-Manuel Miranda has a bunch of projects. Leslie Odom, who plays Aaron Burr, he's great. I don't know what he has lined up. The guy who plays George Washington, he's got a sitcom coming up. You know, they've been on this show for a year and a half or two or three or 5 years if you're Lin-Manuel. So they've been on it a long time.
Yeah, but how often do you get the President of the United States to give your intro? You know, let's throw to the president. He'll do the intro for Hamilton. And anyway, good luck the rest of the nominees.
Well, that was the smart thing about the show. They didn't pretend that they did not have this phenomenal once in a generation show. They celebrated it rather than trying to pretend there was some sort of suspense. Barbara Streisand wore revolutionary garb to hand out the best musical. So I thought that was cool. And I think we'll be, you know, they're taping the show. Like with multiple cameras, they're going to record the show, not to be shown in theaters or anytime soon, but they want to capture this cast before they're gone. And I think that's a smart thing to do. And we're going to see more shows being live streamed at the end of their run. Broadway's She Loves Me, which got a lot of love on the Tonys, that is going to be offered as a live stream on, you know, in it's not going to be in movie theaters like you'd see for the Metropolitan Opera or the National Theater. It's going to be on Apple and Roku and other outlets. They're going to do that June 30th. Because the show closes July 10th, why not? You're seeing more and more shows doing that. It just makes sense. Why not get that last little bit of income from a show that's about to close?
Well, not only that, but then I could go and buy the cast album if I really like it.
That's right.
So, yeah, I mean, look, everybody knew Hamilton was going to win. It did. It won 11 awards. It was nominated for 16. I think some of the awards it lost was because the other person from Hamilton won in that category.
Right. Well, a few. It did not win Best Actress, but we knew that, you know.
Right. Okay. So
it even won some we thought it wouldn't, like choreography and lighting or costume. You know, there were some things that were, it would seemed it's touch and go. And in fact, they triumphed. They won 11 Tonys, a ton.
Yeah, I mean, nobody's ever won. Although, here's something interesting.
They've won 12.
Oh, okay. I sat next to the lighting designer for the Tonys on the trip from Orlando to Los Angeles.
Well, very fun. A Tony winner.
And he was reading the book Hamilton. And the only way I know he was the lighting director for the Tony Awards is I said, hey, have you seen Hamilton? He said, hey, I saw it last week because I had to see it to light the scene in Hamilton. But, you know, I think what Hamilton did do, they should have done that song, Throwing Away My Shot, or what.
Yeah, that would multiple choices.
Yeah, they did kind of customize it for the Tonys. So at least that kind of worked.
Yeah.
But now you said 9 million people watched it. The remake of Roots, which aired on the History Channel and put up some very good numbers, the overnights for that, for the first episode, was several million, which is great totals for history. And of course, everyone pointed out that no TV series today could match the stunning numbers of the original series some 40 years ago. But then the Live Plus 7 numbers came out, and instead of 4 million viewers for the first episode, which is what the overnights were, it was, get this, Michael, 14 million viewers. That would rank it in the top 10 of all network TV that week, the week it aired, easily. But will anyone remember that when the first number reported was some 4 million viewers, that the overall viewership was over 14 million? Probably not. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. Again, they should just remain mum. You cannot give the final score in the middle of a game. You cannot report how many people watched your show 5 hours after it aired. And if you do that, you're only punishing yourself. So I think it's a mistake. They should follow the lead of other people and wait at least for the Live Plus 3.
Yeah, I mean, I think in part the question is, did the 10 million extra viewers actually watch any commercials?
Well, you know? That's a different issue.
Yeah.
But the fact is they had a big audience.
A court of appeals in D.C. ruled that high-speed internet is, in fact, a utility. In a 2-1 decision, it supported new FCC rules and essentially confirmed the government agency has a strong incentive to more heavily regulate and oversee this essential service, and the government agency in question, of course, the FCC. Naturally, internet providers plan to appeal. Big deal or big whoop?
I will punt that back to you.
It's a big deal. Because it is, the big question was, the FCC took legislative or regulatory action. Would it stand up in court? So far, it has. And really, what the court is saying is, yeah, you know what? Sometimes service providers don't do what they say they're going to do. You need somebody to, you know, a lifeguard there to kind of say, hey, don't jump or run around the pool.
And this is not, you know, jewelry or fine dining. This is an essential. It is like water and heat. And, you know, internet, it is an essential utility into people's homes, and it has to be treated that way.
Well, and half the government things I do now, I can't do in person. I have to do it online first, which
that's true,
is annoying because those websites are usually quite bad. But
and how does it affect our viewers? Well, 23% of millennials are apparently over the top only when it comes to accessing television. That's higher than the national average. But guess what? Millennials are also more likely to subscribe to both cable and OTT services. So, you know, it's like, yeah, they may be more likely to be over the top, but they're also more likely to pay for it all. So, you know, don't despair yet, cable company people. Just make sure you provide a good product at a good price.
That is true. Paramount beat the Musicians Guild over a lawsuit about film scores being done overseas in violation of their standing agreement. This is interesting. Turns out the case was resolved not over the issue at hand, but simply on the definition of the word producer and the word employer. Essentially, Paramount claimed it wasn't the producer of the film.
That's not our film.
Just that it had a first look agreement to fund 40% of movies made by a certain production company. Yeah, Paramount Pictures. The guild said, come on. Anyone funding more than 25% of a movie is a producer. Just ask anybody who funds over 25% of a movie and wants to be called a producer. The judge dismissed the guild rule of 25% as having no basis in any agreement or contract.
Fair enough.
Yeah. However, the judge said Paramount was a producer since it made weekly payments, saw dailies, and so on. You know, it acted like, you know, a producer. But was it an employer? This time the judge said no. Thus, the agreement made with the guild wasn't applicable because Paramount wasn't really the employer of record. It was the production company. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop. Because now all it means is the next time people renegotiate guild contracts or whatever rule, they got to just redefine employer.
That's right. Or they just say with the producer, not the employer.
Yeah.
I mean, this is a no-brainer. It's this is done by studios all the time. They never
make their own movies. Right. Yeah. So it's really ingenuous at best.
Right. Best-selling author James Patterson specializes in quick, easy page-turning thrillers, but now he's launched Book Shots. That's where you stuff a book into a shot glass.
No.
It's a series of even quicker, shorter page-turning novelettes that are designed to be read in one sitting. The first two titles are out and they sold a combined 30,000 copies. Where they were sold will also be interesting, since Patterson hopes to reach casual fans by having these $5 paperbacks stocked at registers, in drugstores, and the like, where folks don't usually find books anymore. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I'm not sure. I think it's a big deal. It's a big whoop, probably. It's an add-on little thing, trying to get books in places where they're not usually found. A friend of mine sent me a thing in Singapore. They have book vending machines. For like Singaporean authors to try and help promote local authors. They have nice little books in vending machines that you can just vend and get a book. You know, there aren't bookstores everywhere. There's not a lot of space.
Wasn't I that friend?
Oh, was it you?
Yes.
I'm sorry. I forgot who it was. What you talking about, Willis? By the way, you're right. Different Strokes jumped from NBC to ABC for like a final season. So I think this is kind of interesting. It's funny that he would be the guy to do it because his books are already so quick and easy to read. But hey, you know, we'll have to see where it ends up. I'm not sure how much a normal James Patterson book would sell in its opening week. That's why I'm hedging my bets. Maybe he normally sells 50,000 copies, and in which case this was less successful. I wasn't able to figure out that opening week number for James Patterson, but it sounds like a good deal. And you know, and you're talking about books in the industry, and I'm talking about what's working, what's not working. I'll tell you what's really working. It's audiobooks.
Oh, really?
We've got a,
We've got a link in our show notes, but audiobooks are really the area of growth in North America. It's coloring books for adults, and audiobooks are really where you're seeing a lot of healthy growth. People are really cottoning on to listening to books digitally on their phones, in their cars, and all that. It's working overseas, where audiobooks are really popular in India and taking off even more. So when you're looking for success stories in the book world, maybe Bookshots is one of them, but audiobooks definitely are.
Nice try, VidAngel. Following the lead of Redbox and the now defunct Zadiva, the company has tried a workaround Hollywood's rules, and now they're being sued by, of course, Hollywood, major studios. Here's the deal. They quote-unquote sell, a lot of quote-unquotes today, they sell you a new movie on Blu-ray or DVD for $20, which is, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Then you get immediate access to a digital copy you can stream and watch. So that's, wait, I bought a DVD, but I have a, okay.
Just like Amazon does with your CD.
Right. Then you sell it back to VidAngel for $19. In essence, you get to stream the movie for $1 a day. In comparison, you can rent, say, Zootopia on Amazon for $6. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I assume it's a big whoop because it won't stand up in court.
No, I don't think this is going to stand up at all. Basically, Zadiva said, look, we're not going to...
Well, this is VidAngel.
Yeah, I understand. And I'm going back to Zadiva for just a moment because VidAngel is kind of shifting a little bit, kind of pivoting off of what Zadiva did. Zadiva had a whole bunch of DVD players, and they would put the DVD in a DVD player, press play, and you could watch it on your, and you could control the DVD player from your set-top box or your television or your smart TV or whatever. But the DVD player was in Zadiva's data center. Okay, but they actually had DVD players, and it was basically a long cord. Okay, yeah. And the court said, "Yeah, no, it's video on demand. This is not DVD."
But why is VidAngel different from Redbox?
What VidAngel is doing is actually saying we're using the first sale doctrine, which is what Zadiva was trying to do, and we're going to take this DVD. We're going to sell it to you. You now own it. Now, for you, we will stream it to you. Okay, we will do this on your behalf.
And that's what they don't have the right to do?
And I think that's where they're going to get caught up, is that they really, it's a workaround, and much like Aereo was a workaround for cable, I think that courts don't like workarounds, and I think it's going to get shot down.
But it worked for Redbox.
Well, Redbox is actually giving you and renting you. They're not selling you anything. They are using the first sale doctrine the way it's meant to be used.
Okay.
So...
And the problem VidAngel also did was that they made parentally friendly, you know, PG versions of movies available. So they're also editing them.
Right.
Which is even a worse problem. Why make life difficult for yourself? And there's such a small audience for that. I don't know why they'd bother. But everybody cares. They want, and this messes up the windows too, right? This is why the Hollywood cares even more than the fact that they're undercutting their price.
Right. Because, of course, they're selling the DVD and VidAngel.
The day it's available on DVD.
Yeah. Right. And Redbox might not have it for another month.
Well, they don't like Redbox either.
No.
But they usually are making it available as a video on demand by the time the DVD comes out, correct?
Correct. It's early electronic sell-through. Well, yeah, I mean, that's part of that window.
All right.
Noticed a lot of soccer on ESPN lately, Michael. Have you noticed that?
I have.
Yeah, that's right. It's Euro 2016, and for the first time ever, ESPN is devoting substantial coverage to European football, some 300 hours in all, and I'm loving it. Call it a coming of age, maybe, for soccer, or a sign of the times now that the U.S. is more diverse than ever. True, it's becoming less European, actually, but football has fans all over the world. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It's not. It's just a natural evolution in the popularity of a sport, and I think from now on, we should just say football.
I agree.
When we're talking about American football, which is once a year for the Super Bowl, we can say American football. Other than that, let's just say football.
Yeah, I mean...
You know, because enough with the soccer. I mean, it used to be soccer even in Europe up into the 70s. So they called it soccer and football interchangeably, but clearly now they've embraced football because it's played with the foot.
Are you sure that they used soccer?
Yes, I am. There's a biography of a major British captain and coach, and it's like King of Soccer or something like that. That's the name of a very popular British biography up into the 70s. So they were going, somebody was saying, yeah, don't get all uptight, England. You guys called it soccer too, right up until, you know, suddenly you didn't. But again, it's a sport played with the foot. Therefore, they call it football.
Do you remember
American football with the hand? We'll call it American football when we mention it, which is virtually never.
Do you remember when the big press conference for David Beckham when he signed with the LA Galaxy?
Didn't watch it.
And he, well, you know, neither did I, but I saw the highlights. And the one of the biggest highlights was when he said, you know, I've always wanted to come to America to play football. And people were like, what? You did? You need more pads. But yeah, I agree. We should call it football. Now, hey, Michael, if it makes money, you know Hollywood will figure out how to make a sequel. Casablanca? Well, why not? Though they haven't yet. And The Passion of the Christ? The highest grossing independent film in movie history? A no-brainer, especially since the plotline is already set in stone. Literally, Jesus comes back from the dead. Yes, Mel Gibson is planning a sequel to the Aramaic drama, with Randall Wallace writing the screenplay that will focus on the resurrection. I don't know whether it's the resurrection of Jesus or Mel Gibson's career. Big deal or big whoop.
Nice, nice joke. I'm assuming they're going to focus on the apostles. I mean, there's nothing to say more about Jesus. He's like, hey, I'm back and I'm leaving. You know, so I assume it'll mostly focus on the apostles and what when they acts of the apostles, them going out and proselytizing. That way, Mel can double down on the torture porn. You know, in the first movie, he ended with one crucifixion. In the second film, he can torture and kill a bunch of people, winding up with the upside down crucifixion of one of the apostles. So you'll get, you know, twice as much torture porn for your money.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And as we mentioned at the top of the show, we're going to be joined by Ann Thompson, editor-at-large at IndieWire. And this past week, there were a number of executive moves at 20th Century Fox and over at Viacom. I don't even know what happened at Viacom, but Ann Thompson is here to tell us all about it and try to help us figure it out. Ann, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, as always. Haven't seen you since Cannes.
Yes, indeed. Now, I guess, and actually, when we last saw each other, Doug Belgrade was the head of Columbia Pictures, and I'm sure that there's somebody else somewhere that was the head of some studio that is now no longer the head of some studio.
Well, Philippe was on the board of Viacom.
That's true. Philippe DeMann was on the board of Viacom.
Then they had the Red Wedding.
They're getting rid of him, but, you know, there's a process there.
Well, then they had the Red Wedding, and everybody was removed. They're
exactly
in the process.
Yeah.
I know. This is really a game of Survivor. You know, I always said that if I ever had to bet on anyone in the business, whether he's in his 90s or not, to win a game of Survivor against anyone, it would be Sumner Redstone. Here he is, you know, doddering and drooling and you know, people fighting over his domain, and he's calling it. He's still calling it.
He's clinging to the windowsill.
Exactly. That is the image to use.
Well, and we should mention, for those who don't know, he actually survived a fire, a high-rise
literally,
fire.
He did climb out of a window and hung by his hands and burned one of his hands. One of his hands is still, you know, mashed from that experience, but he survived.
And he is now the head of Viacom. He's 80% owner of Viacom, which owns Paramount, owns CBS. And there's this little war going on where, you know, he's 93. They were looking for a succession plan. He was the chairman and CEO. They kind of forced him out. And now Philippe DeMann, who was and is in charge, he's kind of overseeing a crumbling empire.
He was his trusted lieutenant and apparent successor. And what's happened is that that's no longer the case. And Sherry Redstone, his daughter, who Redstone Sr. has had a very tumultuous relationship with, she's about 60-something, and she, you know, runs National Amusements. He tried to take it away from her. That's his exhibition company at one point. She's the one who's really maneuvering now to make sure that these five people were taken off of the board, including Philippe DeMann. And we'll see. You know, he's still running Viacom, DeMann, and he still says that he's going to get rid of, you know, sell part, at least, of Paramount, which is what, you know, Redstone no longer wants him to do. It is a fascinating and Shakespearean drama that is unfolding.
But in part, I mean, I kind of wonder, you say that Sumner Redstone is still kind of like
calling
the shots, so to speak. But it's kind of iffy or questionable if he is. None of the board of directors can actually see him. He is the primary and largest shareholder. So
he drove onto the Paramount lot, you know, to sort of say hello to Brad Gray, the head of Paramount. But he never got out of the car. He can barely walk. He can barely talk. The question is he capable of communicating? He doesn't talk on the earnings calls anymore. Right. You know, he supposedly listens in on them. It's hard to say.
But if Sumner Redstone had his full faculties, wouldn't have all this happened years ago? Since this is not a man known for patience over, you know, fading fortunes of a particular divisions of his company.
Well, he's the one who got rid of the head of MTV, Tom Freston, because he was mad at him for not getting MySpace, you know, which went to Fox. And and so, you know, hardly something that they turned out, you know, that they would have wanted. But no, he doesn't forgive. And he's apparently not forgiving Domon for the poor performance of Viacom. I mean, they have just been in sort of really slimmed down, cut back, not growth mode. And, you know, I know Paramount better than any of the other. I mean, CBS is going strong in its separate entity under Les Moonves. You know, they're doing great, but the Viacom side is not doing well at all.
That's the music. So musical chairs are still going on at Viacom, but Fox, they seem to have settled down. Everybody has a new chair. What's going on there?
All right. So what happened there is that they brought in Stacey Snyder, who is one of the sort of storied executives in Hollywood. She had run her course with Steven Spielberg at DreamWorks, which had become a much smaller entity and is now totally ensconced over at Universal with Participant and Reliance and everything. It's more Amblin now, Amblin Partners. And so she was going over to be the second in command, sort of replace the Tom Rothman role with Jim Giannopoulos, now that Rothman's over at Sony, replacing Amy Pascal. So the transition wasn't smooth because she was coming in from the outside. Even though she's very well respected, they were doing well at Fox. They were, you know, they had The Martian, they had The Revenant with New Regency, they had, X-Men movies and so forth. And so she basically has been sort of trying to, you know, deal with Emma Watts, you know, Elizabeth, who's the head of production there. Elizabeth Gabler at Fox 2000 was up, still answering to Jim Giannopoulos. Jim still very close to James Cameron and these, you know, planned four Avatar sequels. And so she really hadn't found a purchase. And the new people who are running the sons of Rupert Murdoch, Lachlan and James, basically decided that they were going to give her the reins and say, you are in charge as soon as Jim, gets kicked upstairs at the end of his contract in June 30th, 2017.
Now, it did seem to me that it was spun as, no, this is a promotion for Jim Giannopoulos.
It's always like that. It's the kicked upstairs, you know, it's the emeritus role. I would argue that Jim will still, from what I understand, he will still be involved with Cameron, because why wouldn't he? And also that he will still be involved, probably supervising the international side, especially since this guy, Sanford Panich, who has gone over to work for Tom Rothman.
And it will take less than a year, right? His contract is June of 2017, but there's no way he's going to stay in his current job till then.
I don't think so, no. And I think there will be a now the transition will really take place, and Stacey will be the boss, and people will answer to her, and she will have control over making decisions about what gets made and what doesn't get made.
Now, so she makes history. She'll be the first female executive to run two different Hollywood studios. More credit to her. She has a great track record of movies that she's been involved with over the years, but I'm just not wildly impressed by the recent history of her time at DreamWorks or here at Fox, where she sort of sat on her hands and didn't want to make any mistakes. That's how it's being painted.
I don't know,
18 months here,
18
months there.
Way.
That doesn't really strike me as a really, a great credit to her career.
Well, I can tell you that from the DreamWorks perspective, where I, you know several people there who for years were trying to get movies made. They had the money and they were trying to get movies greenlit, and she was standing in the way. She did not want to greenlight anything. And it eventually became very clear that she wanted to run a studio, and the only way to get back into being the head of a studio was to not make any mistakes in her current position. So 18 months in, after not greenlighting anything for 18 months, she left. They greenlit three movies within 3 months.
So that's the negative spin on her.
The other thing was that they had become a much smaller entity. There really was a smaller budget pool to work with, and I just think it has become very difficult to make the movies, the high quality movies that a label like DreamWorks wanted to make. And I don't think they really fit into the fabric over at Disney, the new label structure, the kinds of commercial movies they wanted to make over there. So I think it was an organic. She wanted to get out at a certain point, no question. And it went, you know, the interesting thing about DreamWorks was that it was always the Steven Spielberg show. And she eventually discovered this, and she eventually had to deal with that. He really was the powerful entity that served his own needs in that universe. And finally, I think Stacy had a lot more going for her than being his development executive. I really do. And I want to see what she does. She did very well at Universal.
At Fox,
I want to see what she does. And so far at Fox, she's had to do the existing power structure there. And she's been quietly maneuvering, and this is the end result.
Well,
now she can really, you know, they now know that she's in charge.
Well, and I think you mentioned this quiet maneuvering. There was some discussion in the media and actually in the industry of, look, you know, there was some question as to why she was there in the first place. As you say, she didn't really find her purchase there or didn't find a place for herself, and she was tired of it. And so she basically went to senior management and said, do something about this and do it sooner rather than later. And this is what they did. They finally announced what was ultimately going to be what happened anyway in 2017. They just announced it, you know, about a year early.
So I guess we'll wait 3 years and then we can say, all right, now you've had a chance to prove yourself when you're in charge, and we'll see what kind of track record she has. Not the first three movies she makes, but give her 3 years and see what sort of slate she has and what's coming up. And then we can start to judge how she does when she's given the power to make her decisions.
I agree with that completely. It takes a while.
Let me ask you this, because I kind of look at moves such as this, and I go back to, and this is going to sound like a strange comparison, but to the Jay Leno, Conan O'Brien debacle, where it was, hey, Jay, you're getting up there in years, you're in your 60s, and we don't think that the millennials will watch you anymore. Even though you're number one in the ratings, we want to kick you out of late night. And I look at Jim Giannopoulos, everybody loves this guy. He's known as, you know, a well-respected executive. He's 65, he'll be 66 next year. Yes, he's nearing retirement age, but at the same time, he's one of the most well-respected studio heads in the business today, and he hasn't done anything wrong. The studio's running fine. Why kick him out just because he's not he's Rupert's?
He's his dad's man.
Yeah, he's Rupert's Murdoch's man, not James.
Well, they haven't kicked him out, and he's still, as I said, I think he's still going to be running, you know, the international side and the Cameron side, and those are pretty important things to be involved with.
But it's a demotion. He was in charge, now he's not in charge.
He's going to be a consulting entity, an emeritus entity. We will see. We will see what he becomes. But I'm happy to see Stacy get her chance again. I think she's a capable executive.
Well, there've been a lot of changes at Fox, and there've been a lot of changes at IndieWire, and things have settled down there. What's life like at IndieWire right now? Because we all read and look at your website all the time.
I'm happy to hear that. That's great. It was tumultuous. We were hiring people. We were letting go of the blogs. We were relaunching on WordPress. We were worried, you know, maybe the traffic would be tough to get back, you know, when you do all of those things that you don't know where it's going to go. And it's all worked out. We're smoothing it out. It's getting to be in a good groove. We got a great team. I know I sound like a cheerleader, but I'm really excited by the quality of what we're doing on the site.
I've noticed that Huffington Post is downplaying their blogs, mostly because I write one for them. So I'm noticing the personal blogs are sort of being downplayed or disappearing from certain sections of that site. Is there some overall online trend to getting away from a bunch of different verticals, or what's the thinking?
I actually think that what the Penske Media people figured out was that IndieWire needed to be IndieWire. It needed to be the brand, and it needed to be the core, and it needed to be in sync and coordinated and with a plan, you know, an editorial editorial plan. And now that that's true, you don't have sort of multiple box office stories or multiple versions of those things that break in the morning that everybody puts up on every single site. We figured out the best IndieWire way to do each of those things. And it's no longer a hodgepodge. It feels coherent and it's working. So I feel good about it. And I think that's the, you know, we needed to create, you know, a properly editorially syncopated IndieWire.
Well, certainly you relaunched recently. We'll place links to all of your stories in our show notes, especially the one here about Stacey Snyder and Fox and also the ones about that you've written about Viacom. And I'm speaking for Michael, but I appreciate your coming on to tell us all about it.
My pleasure. And anytime, I'll be happy to come back.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, it was nice of Ann Thompson to stop by.
Yeah, I always love talking to Ann. I mean, every single time you learn something new and interesting and you get something from a fresh perspective. I think the news on Friday, this news about Jim Giannopoulos and Stacey Snyder did kind of surprise everybody, at least the industry.
Yeah.
And how does it affect our listeners? Let's face it. This is the woman that brought a lot of movies to Universal that all of which are now escaping me. But like The Mummy and Jason Bourne, Aaron Brockovich, American Pie, Meet the Parents. And so it's basically what is the future of movies and the movie output of 20th century or now 21st century Fox going to be? That's now in Stacey Snyder's hand. But I just wonder, I understand Jim Giannopoulos is nearing retirement age. It's just, you know, this is a guy who oversaw the studio during some tumultuous times going from the analog world to the digital world. And he actually did a decent job. Why get rid of him?
Nearing retirement age, tell it to Sumner Redstone. He's got 30 years to go.
Yeah, that's true. tell it to Bernie Sanders, who's,
he's like, I want to be president.
Yeah, exactly. I'm 10 years older than you and I can still be president. Yeah.
Hollywood obviously always reacts to anything in the news. It doesn't matter if it's related to Hollywood or not. Celebrities naturally go take to Twitter. You hear what people say and think about all sorts of things these days. But it makes more sense when it's something in their community, like an unexpected death of a young actor. Anton Yelchin died over the weekend. He plays Chekhov in the new Star Trek film series. He's 27 years old, a bizarre freak accident. He stepped away from his car, went to the bottom of his driveway, and the car went in reverse apparently and pinned him and killed him. It was just an awful, sad thing. And obviously people take to the thing to talk about. I interviewed him once, so somehow I feel like I have some connection to him, which is silly, but there you go. You know, you talk to a guy, feel like you know him, a young guy. He just graduated high school practically. I mean, that's what we talked about. That's how young he is. Back then, it was for a movie called Charlie Bartlett, and he's like 20 years old. And I'm talking about what he did for high school graduation. He didn't go to prom. He went to his friend's recording studio and recorded music because he loved music. So, you know, he's just a kid, you know.
Right.
So sad news, obviously.
You know, that is the one thing I did notice about this particular story is that he was so accessible over the last 10 years that there were so many people posting pictures of themselves with Anton Yelchin from usually press interviews. I mean, because, you know, we run in press circles, so it's usually interviews of, from a press day. And there he is in like one picture after another.
I think that could be true of anyone these days with smartphones. I don't know that
that's
he was
true. That
unusually
true.
Accessible, but, you know, there you go. Who knows what he might have done? Very sad. Throw some projects into turmoil. You know, boo-hoo, of course, the sad thing is that the guy died.
Well, maybe, you have pictures of yourself with Anton Yelchin. And if you do, you can email them to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can, you know, call and leave us a voicemail. You can't send a picture that way, though. 888-567-SAND is our voicemail. That's 888-567-7263. And please do call, write, send us your feedback, your thoughts. We'll play them on the air. We'll read them in a future episode. You can subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. We can usually be found there. And if we can't, write to us, call us, let us know, and we'll make sure to be found there. And please do subscribe to the show, rate and review the show in those aggregators. It does help us out. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you can find those ways to contact us, ways to follow us. You can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, Showbiz Sandbox. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox and our page should come up. Links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode can be found again on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's Showbiz Sandbox. We got a 99% rating on RottenTomatoes.com.
And if you can't spell that, because that is a lot of words, so if you have some trouble there, then maybe head on over to the Huffington Post to read some of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry, or you can go to michaelgiltz.com to find all of his work aggregated there. And of course, don't forget about bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.